From WXXI News, I'm Evan Dawson. This is Connections. It has been a momentous year for the Finger Lakes wine industry. From the fracking decision recently that's been hailed as a victory for the region by those in the wine industry, to new investment from some of the top wine names coming from around the world, choosing the Finger Lakes. This hour, we have a number of guests from the industry talking about the year in Finger Lakes wine, the year on the economic side, the year on the weather side, looking at the possible weather damage from last winter, what turned out to be the reality this harvest, what kind of year can we expect when 2014 hits the bottle, and what about the fracking decision? How will it impact the region going forward? My first guest for the hour is Rick Rainey. He is a co-owner of a project called Forge Cellars, primarily based on Seneca Lake. Now, the project is Rick, along with Justin Boyette, who's a winemaker and co-owner of the Hector Wine Company, and a Frenchman named Louis Barol from Gigondas, France. Now, Louis Barol, one of the hot winemakers in the world, who chose the Finger Lakes for his big project. Rick is his co-owner, and Rick joins us now from Seneca Lake after what has been a very busy few weeks.
Wonderful, Evan. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, I know this has been a huge week or two in the Finger Lakes when it comes to state decisions. We see arrests on an almost daily basis at the Crestwood facility and the issue of LPG storage. We'll get to that in a moment. But there's also a huge issue of fracking. And I'd love to know, Rick, how the governor's decision played to your expectations. Is this what you thought he would do?
You know, this is crazy. I was grabbing a sandwich in the Glen Mountain Market down in Watkins, and a stream of people were coming in that had been protesting, had been filming the protest, and I was speaking to one of the protesters, and they were asking me, there was rumors actually that something was happening, and nobody quite knew what was happening, but it was at that very, it was all going down at that very moment. And they said, you know, Rick, what do you think is going to happen? And really, I thought that the governor was going to allow fracking in the southern tier. Obviously, worst case scenario for those that were opposed to it. But I really did think that that's what was going to happen. So when the state came out totally against fracking, I thought it was a monumental decision. And from a bunch of standpoints, obviously it's an issue that's difficult for some people because I understand the southern tier economically is really challenged. And for a lot of people, they thought of this as a lifeline. But I think ultimately the way I view it is it was the best thing the governor could have done for the quote-unquote brand of New York. So I was surprised, but elated, and I really thought it was forward-thinking, and I commend the administration for taking such a serious stance against fracking. It's pretty remarkable.
Rick, you are a co-owner of Forge Cellars, and for those who maybe know the Finger Lakes wine industry but, you know, aren't down there all the time or aren't into it on a day-to-day basis, Forge Cellars is a relatively new name, just a few years old. But your wine project has been front and center in the question of fracking and LPG storage because one of your co-owners, Louis Barol from Gigondas, France, is considered truly one of the great winemakers in the world. So before we get to sort of your place in this debate, let me just ask you to explain to our listeners what Forge is and a brief history of how it came to be in the Finger Lakes.
I've been in the French wine business for many years now, and it's a fairly small world. And I became friends with Louis because I was working with his wines in the States. And one afternoon while having lunch in Gigondas in the Southern Rhone Valley, he mentioned he'd love to do a project outside of France one day. And I said, you know, it's interesting. I live in this area called the Finger Lakes that I think has great potential and is starting to realize it, but we really have no idea what we can do, and it's an exciting time. It's not the easiest place in the world to make wine, but the potential is great. And he kind of gave me one of those French looks. And a few months later, in 2009, he was here in the Finger Lakes, and he, Justin, our other partner, and I were banging around looking at vineyards. And shortly thereafter, he said, you know, let's do a project here. I really want to do a project in the Finger Lakes. So it took us a couple of years to put it together. Our first vintage was 2011. So, of course, Mother Nature, you know, we said we wanted to start with a difficult vintage, and Mother Nature was kind enough to oblige. But we did well, and we convened after the 2011 vintage to decide if we could make a go of this, if we could compete on an international stage, and we decided to. So now here we are in 2014, and we are, you know, in the process of purchasing property and building a winery, which everybody's pretty excited about. Louis, you know, every year loves this place more and more. He affectionately calls it the Lakes, and he'll be here in just a few weeks, actually, and we're really, really, really excited about the future. Thus far, I mean, everything we've wanted to accomplish, we've gone in that direction. So.
No pressure on you and Justin Boyette, your other co-owner on the American side, right? I mean, only for years have we heard the notion of a Finger Lakes partnership with the great European winemaker. We've heard it floated. It's certainly been a desire of some of the other wine producers in the region. You're the first to bring in someone of this caliber. So no pressure on you to manage the day-to-day, right?
No, none at all. No, I mean, honestly, if you're going to have partners, pick the best ones you can possibly find. So I lucked out, didn't I?
I would say so.
Phenomenal. I mean, Louis, just his insight, what he brings, what he's taught Justin and I. You know, Justin and I have had no formal training in this, and Louis really, he's schooled us. I mean, we've learned so much by working with him, and he's brilliant. I mean, he didn't achieve what he's achieved in the world of wine by not being quite good at it. And I'm happy to call him my partner. I learn from him every single time I talk to him.
Can you explain, what is a French look?
You know, the furrowed brow and the chin kind of goes back into the chest a little bit, and the brow furrows and the shoulders rise ever so slightly, and normally one shoulder's higher than the other. That's the typical French look.
It's almost like a cartoon character of what we would think of as a Frenchman, right?
Exactly.
We're talking to...
And Louis is sometimes a cartoon character. I mean, this is such an interesting fella. He, you know, he makes great wine, has an amazing team that is so loyal to him in France, has done amazing things with his property, but then he turns around, plays rugby any chance he can, and then when he's not doing that, he plays the cello. So I'm still trying to figure the guy out.
I'm talking to Rick Rainey, a co-owner of Forge Cellars in the Finger Lakes. And Rick and his operation have been, in many ways, at the forefront of the question of hydrofracking and LPG storage. Not only have Rick and his co-owners sent a letter to the governor urging them to consider the issues, and recently the governor decided to ban fracking in the Finger Lakes, in New York State, I should say, the entire state. But there were questions, Rick, about a couple of things. You've got your project. Paul Hobbs and Johannes Selbach are another pair of winemakers and wine consultants around the world who have chosen the Finger Lakes for a new project. That's a big deal. And there's been talk that your project and their project could be delayed or scrapped if wide-scale fracking and LPG storage went ahead. And I wondered if that was hyperbole or if those conversations, if you've had those with your co-owners.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I can't speak for the Selbach Hobbs project, but without a doubt, I mean, we've discussed it at length, and it's been a huge concern of ours. And for us, I mean, this was all kind of happening right at the time we were signing contracts and going through the motions. And so, absolutely, we're really, really concerned. And so I felt we had to at least express that concern to the governor. I wanted him to know that if we were having these concerns, who else outside of this region without a voice, or even, you know, obviously within the region, that's a given, was having these same concerns. I mean, none of us have unlimited resources. So when you're faced with this choice, putting your life savings into a project and not quite sure knowing what's going to happen in the future, it really does make you pause. So that's why we issued the statement. We thought it was fairly important to at least put the cards on the table. You know, be upfront, be direct. Hey, we are really keen on this. We live here. We love it here. But, man, we're really afraid as to what could happen. And at least one part of that has been answered with the fracking ban.
You live in Trumansburg, and I'm curious to know what it was like in Trumansburg when the fracking decision came down.
Well, I think my wife is finally not mad at me anymore. I went out Friday night, and it was a carnival in Trumansburg. The Rongobian Embassy, which is a famous place that's been around forever, has recently reopened with huge community support, and it was just it was fantastic. I mean, to walk in and great music playing, everybody giving each other hugs and high fives. You know, it was great, but I don't want I don't want to take away from the challenge that we're faced with now. And I think, as I mentioned before, the brand in New York is so important. And now we have to figure out all the ways we possibly can to realize the potential of our lands, to realize the potential of our people. There's people in the Southern Tier and outlying areas that are suffering, that maybe own land but aren't realizing the potential off of this land. So I think, you know, we banned it, great. Now the real work begins. How do we make these people whole? How do we provide a bright future for them? And that's really what I'm waiting to see. What happens next with that? I mean, to me, that's the big next step. We got the fracking out of the way. Now what do we do?
We're talking to Rick Rainey, a co-owner of Forge Cellars. It's a relatively new wine project located mostly on Seneca Lake, and they've got a lot in the works there. Rick, I also want to just briefly touch on LPG storage. We talked about that. If the state allows Crestwood Energy out of Texas to expand LPG and natural gas storage in the salt caverns near Seneca Lake, does that remove the gains that you feel have been made with the fracking decision?
In my estimation, the banning fracking, like I said, preserved the brand of New York. So what are we trying to do? We're trying to make whole these people in these outlying areas that needed fracking to survive. Well, I believe the wine industry is helping. It's not a cure-all by any stretch, but we're having some impact, driving some tourist business. We're driving some manufacturing business. And though it's not nearly enough, we need to do more, obviously. But I think the LPG thing, it strikes at the heart of the Finger Lakes, and that's frightening. That's really, really a scary thought. The impact, not only on a local level, but what it could mean internationally if we have any kind of disaster, anything at all happens, how does that tarnish the Finger Lakes brand now? So it's a frightening prospect.
And Rick, to be fair as well, on LPG, I don't know a whole lot of people who support that project locally, but there were plenty of people in the Finger Lakes who are, I'm not saying the region was split on fracking, but it wasn't 100%. I know some of your neighbors supported fracking. Certainly toward the Southern Tier, there were people who supported fracking. At the same time, this past weekend, I talked to somebody who said, who is pro-fracking, who said that the governor made a decision just to appease Upper West Side liberals. And I thought that that was too, I thought that was unfair to some of the people who've gotten involved in some grassroots activism. That implied that the governor made a decision to appease wealthy people in urban areas as opposed to listening to people in rural areas who were getting involved. So what did you see in terms of actual activism and people getting involved? Do you think that that moved this needle?
Well, I just say to that person, geez, none of us got the memo, because the amount of effort that's been put into this with not only the LPG, you know, storage, but the anti-fracking thing. I know so many people. I could go down a laundry list, farmers, people that are busy, people that don't have a heck of a lot of free time that have spent gobs of time, money, resources in fighting this. So, you know, these statements are made. It's okay. I think it's born out of ignorance, but it's not what I've seen, and I find it simply not to be true.
Let's talk a little bit about wine then, and let's talk about how the year has been. There were a lot of concerns that economically this would be a very difficult year for the region coming out of a rough winter. There were concerns about crop production. Later this hour, we're going to talk to Hans-Walter Peterson with Cornell Cooperative Extension's grape program in the Finger Lakes. But at the same time, I think it's, from what I've seen, Rick, and from what I've heard, this year could have been a lot more difficult. And it showed the resilience of the region. How would you characterize it?
Oh, you know, I mean, our fermentations are still going on our Rieslings because we picked fairly late. And so it's hard to say. I as the guy that kind of takes care of the vineyards and judges fruit quality, from where I sit, I'm ecstatic. We had a prolonged, long fall, these long, cool falls that developed such interesting characters. No, we're stoked. I mean, we're really, really happy. Yields were in check, which can be difficult in these situations because coming out of the winter, nobody knew what to expect. So they left a lot more potential for fruit on the vines, but we were able to manage that. You know, we only make Riesling and Pinot, so my world's kind of limited. But from what I saw, this late ripening of Riesling and very late ripening of Pinot should result in some fantastic wines. They could combine the power of the fruitiness of 12, the minerality and the stoniness of 11 and 13. It could be a crossroads of a vintage, and I think it's brilliant.
Rick, you chose to enter into a wine project in the region after the region had seen remarkable growth to the point where a lot of people thought, well, this is it. We've reached a saturation point in the Finger Lakes. The wine industry can't sustain too many more new operations. That for many years, especially you go back to the 80s and 90s, a lot of wineries tried to exist and succeed selling almost exclusively out of their tasting room, if not to a few local stores. And now the question is, have we reached a saturation point? What markets are we pushing into now? So talk to me about the business side of things. First of all, were you concerned when Forge launched that this was a region that is oversaturated, that there's not enough space for new faces? I mean, obviously, you made the conclusion that you could succeed, but when you looked around, what worried you?
Well, you know, I came here 20 years ago, believe it or not, to work in my first job in the Finger Lakes, and I moved here from Philadelphia, was at Chateau Lafayette.
That's on Seneca. That's on Seneca Lake, I should say. Seneca Lake.
Yes, on Seneca Lake, east side. So it's only taken me 20 years to realize this dream. Our model is probably a bit different than most. Our concentration is not in the tasting room. Our concentration is not necessarily just in cellar door sales or tasting room sales. We have the ability, fortunately, we have a good distribution network. So we spend a lot of our time and our energies kind of outside of our backyard. The backyard is hugely important, and we want to support it. But for long-term good growth, sustainable growth, we have to look far and wide. And, you know, we have distribution in, you know, California and Oregon and Washington and Colorado and so forth. And that's been the way the direction we're going. As far as saturation, I mean, at some point, yeah, I would imagine the region can only support as many tasting rooms as there are tourists, though we continue to see that climb. And some people do it so well, why bother? I mean, the likes of, you know, gosh, the Wagners, or the list goes on, you know, Hector Wine Company, these guys, Ravines, they have such a great tasting room experience. We felt it wasn't needed to replicate it. So we would rather focus on what we can do outside the region, because we have the resources, frankly, for that, that other people may not have. So in order to move the whole region forward, we decided to do what we could do best. And ultimately, I think that will drive tourists back to the region, and it will benefit all of us.
When you approach new establishments, new restaurants, whatever it is, in Manhattan, Chicago, mm-hmm. Boston, Austin, Dallas, wherever you are, what's the reception that you get now, and what's the reception that the Finger Lakes name gets?
It's funny. I just finished up this morning an email conversation in Boston. We were just launched in Boston, and our distributor said, you know, it's the best sign ever when the meeting's over and all our sales reps, you know, 30 or 40 of them are fighting over the leftover bottles. that's about the best compliment you can get. There's a style of wine that we have here in the Finger Lakes that is the right style in the U.S. Kind of palette of styles. We're fresh. We have naturally high acid. We have lower alcohols. We fit in with the kind of the choices that American consumers want. If you want density and richness, you can look elsewhere. But we're making these wines that are very fruit-friendly, that are quite easy to drink. And I think on the world stage, we're unique enough that we can compete. We just showed one of our wines in France, in Strasbourg, in Alsace, which is the home of, you know, cool climate whites. And our wine's going to be on the list at a 3-star Michelin restaurant. They don't make these choices in a bubble. There was obviously a profile of a wine from the Finger Lakes that fit a need for this customer, and they're going to use it. So if that's any indication long term, if we keep all of us keep doing great work, I think internationally we have a real place that is unique and stands alone.
Talking to Rick Rainey for a few more minutes, the co-owner of Forge Cellars, a wine project in the Finger Lakes focusing on only Pinot Noir and Riesling. A little rosé. And Rick's partners in the project include Louis Barol from Gigondas, the Southern Rhone Valley in France, and Louis considered one of the really great winemakers around the world who chose the Finger Lakes for this project. It has been a very interesting year, and we wanted to kind of get a sense for the climate in the Finger Lakes, post-fracking decision, looking ahead, etc. So, Rick, let me close with just a couple of quick thoughts or questions and get your take on working with a great winemaker like that. Let our listeners know, when you're working with a guy like Louis, is he setting the recipe or the plan, and you and Justin and the crew are implementing it? How often is he here? Is he Skyping all the time? I mean, give me a sense for what it's like.
Well, so yes, Skyping, that's all we do. We never talk on the phone. We just Skype regardless of where we are. I don't know why this is, but we like to see each other and feel like we communicate better. He's here, you know, three or four times a year. And is he setting the recipe? Louis and I, fortunately, had been working together, and we knew the wines that each other liked, and we could speak freely about the styles that we enjoyed. And so going into this, we knew where we wanted to go stylistically. So that was fairly easy. Getting there is obviously the more difficult aspect. Louis is quite good at giving us freedom, but at the same time, he's a serious guy. We work very, I guess, seriously. We spend more money in lab tests to make sure things are good than I can even imagine. We have an enologist in France that looks at the wines for us, that gives us guidance. So we have a lot of freedom, but at the same time, we have very high standards. And each year they get higher and higher, and each year we evolve and get better and better. He's been brilliant to work with. I mean, here's a guy that's 45 years old, but every time I spend any length of time with him and I talk about wine, it's as if 500 years of history has been rolled up inside this one fella. And he shares things that still to this day make me scratch my head. And we're just thankful because we can share these ideas and share insights with our friends here in the business. And we have a great group of people we work with. I mean, our growers, are just fantastic. Guys I work with in the vineyards are just brilliant. Our team here is brilliant. I mean, we've created just a great family.
And finally, Rick, when it comes to the day-to-day, you talk about high standards. For anybody who thinks of this industry as, oh, look at Rick Rainey, co-owner of a wine project. What a glamorous life. Take me through a summer and early fall day. Take me through your kind of a day that starts when. When are you up and what are you doing?
Well, I mean, we're all still working, you know. I mean, that's the glamorous side. We're all still working. You know, Louis has his estate. Justin has his kind of quote-unquote day job, which is Hector Wine Company. I have my day job. So we're all working to support this habit. That's kind of all-encompassing sometimes. But all the free time we have is obviously working in the vineyard. So I tend to spend my weekends and any free time early in the morning looking at vineyards, working with growers as to what we want to try to accomplish.
How early? You said early in the morning. You'll get up and go to the vineyards when?
Oh, it's not uncommon to see me sneaking around 6 o'clock in the morning because I don't have so many hours where I have to, take my son to school and these kind of things. So I'll sneak off and meet with growers. I mean, some of my growers, they giggle because I'll show up in the craziest hours and we'll walk through the vineyards and look at how things are ripening, how fruit's positioned, how the canopy's being managed, and come up with strategies. And we're always doing different experiments and see how our experiments are going. There's always a lot going on. It seems as if it never stops, but it's about the most interesting, challenging thing you could ever do. You're certainly not in it for the money, but the joy of growing something great and seeing what Mother Nature can produce is what drives you. So, my stepfather was asking me the other day about the hours we put in, and I just started laughing. I'm like, you just don't count because it's great work. It's just great, great work.
You got to love manual labor.
Indeed. Well, to a certain extent.
I'm not saying you have to love it. You have to tolerate. You have to tolerate manual labor. There you go.
That's right.
Rick, thanks for taking the time, and it's been fascinating to watch your project develop, and I hope we can chat again on the show in 2015. Send our regards to France, to Louis, and see you soon.
Hey, thanks a bunch. Have a great one.
Coming up in our second hour,
We have a discussion on the Finger Lakes outside the wine industry. How's Penn Yan doing after that devastating May flooding? And when will the FEMA aid finally arrive? We get an update on that. We'll also talk about a new approach to education and teaching in 2015 and a new look at how gaming and religion could be tied together. It's all coming up next hour.
Journalist James Fallow says we revere and honor the military, but we don't take it seriously. He says if we did, we'd be more critical, like earlier generations.
Dwight Eisenhower was tough on generals. Harry Truman was tough on generals. Abraham Lincoln was famously tough on generals.
Fallow's on the tragedy of the U.S. military. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4.
My next guest is a winemaker on Seneca Lake, comes from Canada, a long time ago anyway. I mean, it's not like you recently came from Canada. Peter Bell came to the Finger Lakes in 1990, Peter Bell?
1990, and I had been in the Southern Hemisphere for 4 or 5 years before that.
And he's at Fox Run Vineyards now, but is a collaborator on countless projects in this region and really well positioned to talk about, well, how the year has gone, 2014, and some of the other issues surrounding the industry. What's your brief take on the last few weeks here, Peter? We've been talking to some other guests about hydrofracking and some surprises they didn't expect to necessarily see from the state. Are you equally surprised about that decision on fracking?
I am. I would say not, because I knew that Governor Cuomo had this agenda in mind, and he was just playing it really cool, not making it look like it was an emotional decision.
How did you know that?
I guess a hunch became somehow knowledge. So I don't want to say I knew it, but I had a very, very strong feeling that that's what he was up to. He is not the governor of Pennsylvania. He's the governor of our great state.
Okay, so not necessarily surprised, but at the same time, for you at least, many in the industry feel relief. Do you?
Oh, absolutely, relief. Yeah, we have to be careful of hypocrisy, because we all use hydrocarbons in many forms on a daily basis, and we enjoy cheap fuel as much as anybody. But the things that have to go on in our region that would have to go on for that to become a local industry are just antithetical to anything to do with this being a wonderful wine region and tourism region.
People have said, and I have echoed on the program, that there are two prongs to the fracking debate. There's the question on whether the science is sound and the technology is safe, and then there's the question of whether you would want to do it in certain places anyway. And the analogy is, even if you could build a 100% safe, whatever that means, safe factory in the middle of Yellowstone, you wouldn't do it. It doesn't work there. Is that a fair analogy for fracking in the Finger Lakes?
I think it is, yes. There's no question that the Finger Lakes is a gorgeous, kind of one-of-a-kind region. I've been all over the world, and I'm still in awe of the way it looks. And, you know, of course, it's a truism to say once a region is destroyed by rampant industrialism or whatever, there's no going back. You can't restore it to its pristine beauty. We need to keep it as pristine as possible.
Peter, you're also somebody who, having spent time with you, you know, at least on occasion, you go home in the warmer months and you eat food grown in your garden in your backyard. You know, you work long hours. You enjoy good literature and music. Your tastes are pretty simple and intellectual. And you're talking, I think, in a very intellectually honest way about energy. And by that I mean, I don't think people are, hypocrites in a way that is, I don't mean that maliciously. I mean, I'm probably a hypocrite at times, too. We've talked on this program in recent weeks about energy, and yet we all like to be able to flip on the lights and not pay a whole lot. We've talked about values when it comes to working conditions for who made the clothing we wear, but many times, many times I'm not checking on the label to make sure that my clothing was produced in a way that I would find acceptable. So do you think that, you know, there's more of that this conversation, whether it's about fracking, energy, the way we produce, whether it's wine or other goods, it needs to be a little bit more intellectually sort of considerate. And I don't mean that in a way that sneers at anybody. I just think we're all very busy people. But I thought you brought up an important point there.
Yeah, I do. And it troubles me to just turn this into a NIMBY thing. Because, the energy has to come from somewhere. And I envision a world where we basically stop using and squandering so many hydrocarbons. That may mean, I'm not trying to be a Luddite by any stretch, but it may mean getting some, better mass transit network set up, living in smaller homes, keeping the thermostat turned down, getting rid of SUVs, frankly. Those kind of things. Those are all steps where we could probably reduce our energy consumption by 20% or 30% without too much deleterious effect on our own lifestyles.
Yeah, I agree. And what makes me uncomfortable is, especially having worked in West Virginia and having covered the coal industry there, a lot of the thinking about finite resources is roughly 1 to 2 and at most 3 generations ahead. You'll hear people say, well, this resource could last for another 100 years or 200 years. I mean, some of the best music that we listen to was created well before, how am I trying to say this? There's enough time that's passed between some of the best music ever created that we still listen to on Spotify today than there would be for the duration of the rest of some of the natural resources we have, but people tend to think of it as if it's 10,000 years. And I want to think about the world in 1,000 to 2,000 to 5,000 years, hoping, we never see a sort of an intelligent singularity or a nuclear holocaust that kills us. But do you think that people think in a really short-term ways that feels long-term because it'll be after we're gone, but it's not that long after we're gone?
Yeah, it becomes very abstract very quickly. People think, by 2050, you can read some statistic that will claim that by mid-century this or that will have happened and it might be irrevocable or whatever. All you have to do is go, well, I don't think I'll be alive then, so it doesn't really matter. And they'll come up with something new by then. There really is no substitute for fossil fuel energy. There's nothing out there that generates that much power for that small amount of substance. And so, yeah, it's a funny thing to contemplate that we are in this kind of suicide mode right now. But I actually happen to feel that we pretty much are, unless we change things dramatically.
Well, enough on that. My guest is Peter Bell, head winemaker at Fox Run Vineyards on Seneca Lake. And let's talk a little bit about the year in wine and how things are going. Let me start with this. We've talked many times over the years about your travels to other places, other markets, other regions of this country and outside of this country, and I'm always curious to know the reception that your wines and your colleagues' wines are getting in other places. I know it has steadily improved, but how do you view it now as we head into 2015 versus when you first arrived in the Finger Lakes?
Night and day, for sure. That was almost 25 years ago. And this was, it wasn't a pokey little unknown region, for sure. There was certainly lots going on. I'm not going to say unfortunately, but I guess I just did say that. Most of the knowledge about the Finger Lakes revolved around Bully Hill and Taylor Wine Company. Those are fantastic operations, or one of them still is, let's say. I had no interest in being associated with those styles of wine. So the premium wine industry was pretty nascent back then, led by, the likes of Herman Weimer and Dr. Franks and a couple others. But a huge wellspring of potential was quite obvious to anybody who came from another region and saw the kind of grapes we could grow and tasted some of the better wines. And it was a lot of hard work on a lot of people's part. I was one of the people who worked hard. There are many others. The fact that it came to fruition relatively quickly is just so gladdening to me.
When you travel now, everyone knows Finger Lakes Riesling. Are there other, for our listeners who are sort of familiar with the region but may not have that much knowledge about Finger Lakes wines, what do you take with you on the road besides Riesling that makes you really proud of this region?
Oh, right. Generally, that would be red wines, Cabernet Franc or Lemberger. Their novelty value gives them some cachet. And when people end up tasting them in a neutral environment, i.e. they don't have any preconceived ideas of what they might taste like, these wines show very, very well, both to consumers and to professionals. So it's not as if we have to, you know, give a little preamble, you know, this is a kind of high acid, low alcohol, slightly thin wine, but it goes well with food. That kind of verbiage doesn't have to happen. The wines speak for themselves. We'll never be, you know, on the world stage with those wines, but they're so much fun to grow and make and drink that I'm very proud of those.
Maybe not on the world stage the way the high wattage regions are with their flagship varieties, or maybe not on the world stage the way a Finger Lakes Riesling is, but aren't those wines sneaking into some trendy restaurants in different markets? Isn't that fun to see?
They are, and yes, it is. It's really fun to see. I have to give credit, as I always do, to the younger generation, the millennials, who are not coming into this business with preconceived ideas of what constitutes great wine, the way my generation tended to do. And, you know, I meet people who are in their 20s and 30s who say, well, if it tastes good, I'm going to put it on my wine list. And that's all it takes. You know, they'll put a Finger Lakes Cabernet Franc on their wine list, and it'll sell very well, and it's not even a hand sell now.
Peter, I had the Lieutenant Governor Bob Duffy on the program recently, and I know he has become much more of an active presence in the Finger Lakes wine industry, I think very sincerely. You know, you've probably become pretty good at discerning when a politician is pandering and when a politician is sincere. And I think Bob Duffy has spent a lot of time down there and gotten to know some people. He talked about really getting to know the Martinis at Anthony Road, Ruth and Scott Osborne at Fox Run. And one of the things that Bob Duffy talked about on this program was the importance of making sure people, especially in this region, understand that if a Finger Lakes wine is a little more expensive, and it isn't always, but often it might be compared to some of what you would call value wines on the shelves, that there are very understandable reasons for it, not the least of which are volume and scale of production, but also the desire to pay living wages, make sure that those systems are fair, and that we can feel good about spending $16 versus 12 or $14 versus 10 for a bottle of wine. What do you make of that?
I agree with everything you just said. Let's go back to Bob Duffy. Yeah, he's been down to my winery a couple times. We had to go scrounge a brand new pair of size 14 rubber boots for him to wear. Helping me on the crush pad, which he initialed, and there's nobody else wears them because nobody else has such big feet. But he was very sincere, and it was quite clear that he was not doing anything in the, you know, category of electioneering or glad handing. He was just there with a big old grin on his face, having a wonderful time, and that's Bob Duffy. Yeah.
When it comes to the price of a bottle of wine, you know, he made his points on the program. What do you say to our listeners who, again, who might be on the fence when they're in a store? And often I understand people buy the most economical option, but what do you say?
Well, I don't have an answer. I think, you know, we can't compete with the very cheap wine. There will always, always be cheaper wines out there. You know, a $11 or $12 bottle of 1.5 liters of something from another hemisphere, we're not competing with them. It does break my heart when I walk into a local wine store, which I do fairly often, and see that stuff flying off the shelves. However, that is offset by so many other people who are more than willing to pay the extra few dollars. They know we're not doing it to you know, line our pocketbooks. They know what it takes to make good wine and pay a living wage, as you say. And so our production costs are higher, yes, but the pleasure associated with pouring a glass of a local product, knowing where it came from, knowing who made it, and then drinking it and finding it so delicious, that just wiped all those problems out.
Before I let you go, Peter Bell, give me a unicorn wine, and by that I mean a wine that's hard to find but would excite you. I want you to choose a Finger Lakes Riesling from any vintage that maybe exists somewhere. if you could sit down with a bottle that would really excite you from maybe anywhere in the past 5 to 10 years, what would really be exciting to you?
Okay, it would out quite clearly. It would be Riesling, and I always reminisce so fondly about the 2006 vintage, which is going back a ways now. Wonderful vintage for all whites, not so great for reds, but the Rieslings from that vintage across the Finger Lakes had this unbelievable energy in them, and I'm not trying to be too abstract or metaphysical here, but when you tasted them, you got this sense of electricity and tension and emotion, flavor intensity. They were exquisitely balanced. They elicited all these salivary responses in your mouth, which I like in Riesling. And whenever I see one of those kicking around, usually in a friend's cellar or something, and if they're giving me an option of what to taste that night, it'll be one of those 2006 Rieslings.
I saw one on the menu at Red Newt Cellars, Red Newt Bistro, this past summer with my wife, and we couldn't pass it up. And you're on the money with that. They're still a little secondary and sometimes tertiary, but very interesting and really, really good. And we should get together and maybe see what our own cellars produce, Peter.
Hey, talk is cheap, Evan.
I want to have a meal with you, so it's been too long. Peter Bell is the head winemaker at Fox Run Vineyards. And, Peter, we're going to have you on this program tomorrow talking books. I can't wait for that conversation, hear what you've been reading. Thanks for taking the time, and here's to a prosperous and happy 2015.
Likewise, Evan. Thank you very much.
My next guest is Hans Walter Peterson. He's a viticulture extension specialist of Cornell's Finger Lakes Grape Program. We spoke earlier this year, Hans, and one of the things that you and I have talked about throughout this year is that, yes, 10 months ago we were talking about a really raw and rough winter, but you always caution to wait to see the results, you know, frankly, to have a little bit of hope that things will turn out a little better in the vineyards for the vines. What was the end result when it came to the growing season this year, and especially coming out of that winter?
It was really, I won't say necessarily miraculous, but it was. Things turned out a lot better than we kind of anticipated at the beginning of the year. We didn't see as many vines collapsing as we thought there would, and growers were able to kind of adapt some of their practices in order to get some more fruit off of their vines than they might have otherwise. And so, in the end, between kind of growers changing up their practices a little bit and I think probably some luck as well, things turned out pretty good given what we were looking at, like you said, 10 months ago.
And Hans, I know you and I know your work, and no one wants to be in a position where you are doomsaying and then you have to go back and rewrite it. I mean, 10 months ago, there was legitimate concern that this was going to be a crop this year in 2014 that could be down 25-50% or more. That was a legitimate concern at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, and there were certainly some growers in certain places and with certain varieties that did see that. There were some places that lost, you know, well over 50% of their crop. But again, that was only in certain varieties and in certain locations. And so the really hard damage was not as extensive as we were afraid it was going to be. We're still not exactly sure why that was, but you know, in the end, we'll certainly take a better crop than we were anticipating. But it was a really, like I said, I think it's just a kind of a confluence of a bunch of things coming together that really saved the season for a lot of people.
And Hans, it's easy for writers and journalists to get into the narrative, and I know scientists love when we just focus on a narrative. but the narrative might say that this is an indication that this region really is a strong grape growing region, and that if we can come out of a winter like that, not unscathed, but not totally devastated, that it speaks well to our region's ability to grow grapes well. Is that oversimplifying?
No, I really don't think so. I think one of the reasons that we can grow grapes like Chardonnay and Riesling and Cabernet Franc and Pinot Noir here is that, you know, we have these deep lakes that help to kind of moderate the climate. And this past winter, they really seemed to do that job quite well. And so it just kind of proves that there's something special about this place as a place to grow grapes. And you combine that better survival than we thought with a season that started off kind of rough with kind of wet and cool. But then by the end of August, things really kind of turned around and a switch almost got flipped, it seemed like. And end of August and in September and even first part of October were, you know, nice and sunny and dry, not overly warm, but that wasn't as big of a deal. But just that we had some nice dry weather, some sunshine, and really kind of made 2014 a year that we could really be pretty happy about when, again, we were earlier this year was not feeling quite so good.
When it comes to the vintage itself then, and we're talking about the growing season, the harvest, what were the biggest challenges in 2014 once you got into the summer and into the fall?
We had, especially June and July, we had more rain than we really wanted to see. And so anytime that we have higher rainfall or just higher humidity levels, that promotes disease. I mean, anybody who grows plants in their backyard or in a garden knows that. And so it's the same thing with farmers as well. And so we're struggling with some disease problems in some places. You know, we kind of were, that was kind of on the forefront of a lot of people's brains throughout the year. And we're able to, most places were able to keep it under control for the most part, but the concern was what happens when we get towards the end of the season, because a couple of these diseases can kind of raise their heads again once the fruit starts to ripen. And because of that really good weather, we didn't end up with the problems that we were kind of afraid that we might be having. And so, you know, like you said, the change in the season, change in the weather pattern that we got at the end of the summer really helped us out a lot and made, kind of changed the narrative, you know, like you're saying, changed the story a bit from one that was going to be a bit of a struggle to something that was much more of a reason to be hopeful and to actually celebrate once we got to the end of harvest.
We're talking to Hans Walter Peterson, who's a viticulture extension specialist of Cornell's Finger Lakes Grape Program, and his program does a lot of work to help growers to maximize the quality of the fruit that we're seeing. And we're talking about 2014, which was a year with plenty of peril, but it has turned out to be pretty good, and in many ways better than a lot of people expected. That's, as Hans is saying, that's not just sort of a narrative spin or a lazy oversimplification. It could have been much worse in 2014. And now, Hans, before I let you go, I'd love for you to tell our listeners, we tend to think of the wine growing season in terms of seeing the fruit, the harvest, and for good reason, but give us a sense for the off-season work that goes on post-harvest and before fruit set and everything else. If you're working in a vineyard, if you own a vineyard, what are all the things that you have to take care of in these down months?
So yeah, it's the wintertime is kind of the biggest activity going on in the vineyards is pruning, kind of cutting off this year's growth down to a certain level to prepare the vines for next year. And you know, for some growers that work, it goes pretty much all winter long, and for some it doesn't really start until later in the wintertime. Kind of depends on how many acres you have to get done beforehand, and we tend to talk to growers about pruning based on how cold hardy different varieties are. And so things that are very cold hardy, things like Concord and Niagara and Catawba and some of those kinds, some of those vineyards are already pruned. Growers with more cold sensitive varieties like some of the hybrids and most of the vinifera, that stuff won't get pruned until certainly after the first of the year, and probably not until into February or March. Because you want to kind of get past the coldest time of the year before you really kind of make a decision as to how much pruning you're going to do on those vines, depending on how much potential winter injury there is, like we saw last year. So pruning is the big thing that goes on. Once we get kind of into the early spring, they'll be doing things like trellis maintenance. Posts tend to heave and wires get loose and things like that, and so they'll be doing some vineyard maintenance and things like that. But pruning really is the big thing going on right now, and so it's not certainly not vacation time for the growers, but it's a little bit slower at least, and so it's a winter's a little bit slower time out in the vineyards.
When 2014 turns to 2015, what are you going to be drinking?
We got a couple of nice New York sparklers sitting in the fridge at home, and actually heading back to family up in the upper Midwest, and we'll be socking a couple of bottles of New York Riesling into the suitcases.
By the way, Hans just mentioned New York sparkling wine. We've had a chance to hear from Peter Bell this hour over at Fox Run Vineyards. We talked about the different grapes that apart from Riesling that succeed. I don't know if New York sparkling wine gets enough love, Hans, and I'm glad you mentioned it. So this is your chance in 30 seconds to tell our listeners why New York sparkling wine isn't just a good wine to drink to support local, that it really does make sense for the region.
It really does. The grapes that make up going to sparkling wine, you want to have grapes that have more acid to them. And so if you grow grapes in a very warm climate, they don't have a lot of acidity at harvest. And so one of the things that makes wines like Champagne and other sparkling wines really work is that the grapes have a high level of acidity. And in a colder region like the Finger Lakes is, we have grapes that retain their acidity much better. And so it really works well for sparkling wine. And I agree with you. I think some of the ones that we make here are just absolutely world-class and are really deserve to have more of a reputation.
Congratulations on the work this year. And I say that because I know how busy you've been. It has not been 2012, we'll put it that way, in terms of a growing season.
Right.
It's been a lot of work, but I know the many, many growers and winemakers of the region appreciate the work of Cornell's Finger Lakes Grape Program, and so do we. You've been on this program numerous times to help sort of distill things for us, and we greatly appreciate it, Hans. Thank you.
Always a pleasure, Evan.
My thanks to all of our guests from the Finger Lakes wine industry this hour, recapping the year in Finger Lakes Wine 2014. After this short break, we're going to take a look at another issue impacting the Finger Lakes. That was the question of the flooding this past May in Penyan. They called it a 100-year flood. What was the impact? That's just the start of our next hour right here on member-supported public radio.